they could so they can cut them in. So that you can be able to see whether they have budgeted appropriately. We do understand that budgets cannot be ad hoc. We're dealing with estimates with our projections, but it is also important to see whether projections are realistic and whether they are able to cover the whole work that is before the department as per their mandate. What is also important is the analysis of the whole of their equitable share. Just and their program. Yeah, I think it's important that you mention the program because sometimes they set themselves certain targets and deliverables and find that. They don't budget appropriately or sufficiently, or they over budget, or they don't take care of certain issues as per the advice of the SSC and other related stakeholders. So we feel very happy that the SSC is here with us to share their view on the whole equitable share of the Department of or the Economic Development Department. I think we should leave there in terms of the clarification of the meeting of today. So in a few minutes time, I'll be calling in the chairperson. Are you still acting?
Yeah.
My goodness. Yeah, hey. Something must be done, really. Can't be forever. Very long. Long now that you've been acting. Yeah. We, in a few minutes, I'm going to be calling on Mr. Khumalo to introduce the presentation to us. But that is after we have dealt with the second item, which is the apologies. Before that, I really want to welcome also members, especially member Hussein. We're getting a bit worried now that we are no longer attending after a very good record of attendance. I hope that you're going to sustain this.
I hope so.
Going forward. Okay, thank you. Your attendance. Tando, can you take us through the second item?
Good morning, honorable members. I've got three apologies before me. The first apology is from Honorable Pane Mohorofi. She apologized that she won't be able to attend the meeting due to the fact that she has to attend another agent meeting on multitasking. The second apology is from Honorable Ngonyama. He apologized that he won't be able to attend the meeting due to the fact that he is in Zimbabwe this week with the Speaker of the National Assembly and his delegation. And the third apology is from Honorable Kwabanza. He apologized that he won't be able to attend the meeting due to the fact that he's attending a meeting with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry.
Thank you, Tando. What are we saying about the other apology, because really we have indicated that the members must adhere to our meeting schedule. because today is not the trade and industry day. It's the economic development day. So that must be respected, and I think you should really attend to that.
Yeah.
Can we leave it to you to attend it? To attend it?
Yeah. That is the team, and
We have the department reps, we have the PMG also there. Over to then, Dr. Kumar.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I am accompanied by, to my left, Ms. Lillian Tenga. She is the program manager for national budget analysis at the Commission. And then on my right, I've got Mr. Khalid Dawood, who is a program manager for provincial budget analysis. And then I've got Henry Exton, who is our parliamentary liaison officer. Just to start this off, Chairperson, in terms of the letter that we received, basically we were requested to brief the committee on the Economic Development Department's performance for the 2012-13 financial year and its projections for the 2013-14 financial year. And looking at that, we basically thought we haven't yet finished the 12-13 financial year. And so the reports that we basically draw some of the information on are the in-year reports that we actually have access to, I think, up until the third quarter of 2012-13 financial year. But we then go back, because if it's about credibility of budgets going forward, we can actually go back and then look at what the future looks like, and then we also look at the allocations. So we can draw some information also from the annual report, and we then look at it in that particular perspective. Now, I think it's important. Maybe let me start off by also, like, I had some questions earlier about who the Commission is, and maybe just a brief introduction of what the Financial and Fiscal Commission is. It is a constitutional body which is established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution. That's Chapter 13, unlike most of the institutions that support democracy in South Africa. They are found in Chapter 9, except, I think, for the FFC and the Public Service Commission, and I think the language is both. Those are outside of Chapter 9, but they still fall under a big umbrella of the institution supporting constitutional democracy in South Africa. Now, it functions in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, which was promulgated in 1997, although the Commission itself was established in 1994. The enabling legislation was only passed in 1997 after the new constitution was adopted. The mandate basically is very broad, and so looking at all the issues that are in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, in one way or another, they have to do with the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and that is probably the reason why this committee has invited us to come and brief it on the department's budget and what we do. So on any financial and fiscal matter, the Commission can actually be requested to provide some views. The primary focus of the Commission's work is on matters of an intergovernmental fiscal relations nature. That's the primary. So whatever decisions are taken in any one of the three spheres, we then have to look at what the financial and fiscal implications of that are. So if we look at the budget as a macro instrument that government uses to realize its policies, we can look across departments and look at what the implications of an allocation in any one sector, what are the implications going downwards to all the three spheres of government, and we'll will speak a bit about some of those things in the context of the Commission's recommendations that were made for the 2013-14 division of revenue that was submitted in May 2012. I think to get into the main issue of the day, we need to look at the context in which the budget for the 2013 MTEF is actually formulated. I think the minister did indicate the link between the global economic growth dynamics and what ultimately happens in the South African economy. The main driver to growth in the South African economy over the past 2-3 years has really been investment by the public sector in infrastructure. That's one of the major contributors in trying to pull the economy out of the economic recession. So there's quite a substantial amount of money that has been allocated for infrastructure over the period. Now, I think it's important when we talk about the budget also to look at the budget as a broader macroeconomic tool and then link that to what the Department of Economic Development itself must actually do and how it fits into that. So the Department of Economic Development deals mainly with microeconomic dynamics of the budget. So we can allocate money to different sectors. The Department of Economic Development would then have to be playing a coordinating role that basically drives us towards realizing our developmental goals from the way in which we utilize the resources of the country. So the major role of the department is to coordinate microeconomic policies in the country, and that is probably the reason why it is at the center of the new growth path, because it's really about what happens on the ground rather than what happens at the top. So if I were to say something about how the department's budget has performed, already what one would like to see is that, taking into consideration that this is a very new department, and I think now it's almost like getting into its fourth year, we basically can look at its spending pattern from when it was started and to where it is now. It will be demonstrated that there have been successive improvements in the way in which the department spends its money, because it's not a department that is involved in construction, infrastructure projects. So we expect a very relatively linear spending trend, because it's about coordination and making sure that things are actually happening. And that's something that we can, if we have to make a judgment about whether this department is performing well, we can say how much has it been allocated and how much has it been spent and how has it been spending it. We can actually pick that up from the numbers that this department has generally demonstrated that the spending patterns are moving in a very positive direction. Now, because it coordinates a lot of entities that are at the forefront of some of the development or microeconomic policy development initiatives of government, it will be important that when the committee then deals with the department, what is happening in those entities becomes important, because the real output or outcomes of the budget will be realized through the activities of those entities, and we don't look at the activities of those entities here, but we can see what amounts have been budgeted for and what has actually been transferred to those entities, and it's actually looking positive, if I'm not if I'm right, but the numbers will be presented by Lydia, and we can actually engage on that. I think it's important as well as we consider this to keep at the back of our mind the outcomes, the 12 outcomes that government identified in terms of how it's actually delivering on its mandate, and also for the 2013 MTEF, the fact that the National Development Plan becomes the central pillar upon which government activities would be coordinated, or around which government activities must actually happen. So there are some changes that will be required in terms of some of the core issues that the department is doing. And one of the recommendations that we made for the 2013 budget in MTEF is around job creation and the promotion of small, medium enterprises that we think are a very important vehicle through which employment can be created. The response of government to that is that we've got, government already has a lot of job creation initiatives. And we need to look at what role these entities that the department is running, what is their role in those job creation initiatives, and are we making a difference in terms of that direction. Let me stop here and ask Lydia to pick it up from, you need to go to the next slide that's been spoken to. Go to the next slide and then you can, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Basically, I'm going to take you through the budget of the department and how much has been allocated to different programs. Then in terms of the background, basically the department is has four main programs: administration, economic policy development, economic planning and coordination, and economic development and dialogue. Then in terms of its core functions, it has to implement the new growth path, as the acting chairperson has highlighted, and then oversee the policies that relate to the public entities, and also promote competitiveness and decent work by overseeing the public entities that have been identified. Then in terms of the key policy priorities for 2012, the key one is that it's basically promoting investment for economic development and trade competitiveness, basically by increasing the provision of developmental finance. Secondly, implementing an educating competition policy more effectively, and also to create an efficient system of international trade administration. Then in terms of getting to the numbers, basically the department has spent 4674 million, that is in 2010-11. And this amount has increased to 696,518 in 2012-13. The reason for increase basically is related to the increases in compensation of employees, and then there was also additional funding of 30 million that was allocated for building capacity in competition regulation within the economy, and also the issue of the increase in public entities. Then if you look at the growth rate, basically in terms of total expenditure, between 2010 and 2013, the real average growth rate was 27%, and then for 2013 to 2015, that is over the MTF period, it is projected to be 8.1%. As I've highlighted, over the MTF period, in terms of the numbers, it is spending is expected to increase to 987 million. And then this amount includes there's a 450 million that is allocated for the capitalization of the Small Enterprise Finance Agency, which is basically the new agency that was established in 2012. The agency basically combines the operations of Kula Enterprise Finance, South African Microfinance, and IDC. And then there's also an amount of 35.5 million that has been allocated for improving conditions of service in public entities. Then when we looked at the share, of the total allocated amount, basically about 86% of the total budget of EDD is allocated to a program called Economic Planning and Coordination. And then the program consists of several tribunals and development finance institutions, which is overseen by the department. And then if you look at the numbers in terms of the current financial year and over the MTF period, expenditure on this program is expected to increase from 313 million, that is in 2012-13, to 866 million over the MTF period at an average rate of 8.3%. In real terms, basically due to the capitalization of the new entity. Then in terms of the share per program, as you can see, about 86% of the budget is spent on a program called Economic Planning and Coordination. And then that is followed by 8% on administration, and then 3% for economic policy development, and 3% as well for economic development and dialogue. This is basically the allocations for 2013-14. Then basically what we did, we also look at the spending by economic classification. Basically in terms of the total spending, looking at 2010-2013, compensation of employees is 44% in terms of the average growth rate, and this amount is projected to be 29.6% over the MTF period. And then for goods and services, it's 110%. However, it is projected to go down by 6.9%. And then the transfer payment, 17%, and projected to be 11.4% over the MTF period. And then payment for capital assets is 1:1, and then projected to be 13.1% over the MTF period. And then, Chairperson, in terms of the shares, for economic classification, about 79% is allocated to transfers and subsidies, and then about 13% is allocated to compensation of employees, then about 7% to goods and services, and then only 1% is allocated for payment for capital assets. Then what we did also, we looked at the expenditure outcomes per program, that is for 2011-12. Basically, in total, the department has spent about 96.5% of its budget. And then in terms of the program, it has spent almost 100% for economic planning and coordination. Then administration is 88.2%. Then followed by economic policy development, 77.3%, and lastly, economic development and dialogue, which is 62.4%. Then looking at the reasons for the differences or the variances, on the allocated amount. For administration, the 11% underspending is mainly due to slow spending on capital assets, which is influenced by the slow expansion of the department. Then on economic policy program, there's an underspending of 23%, which is due to slow rate of filling of vacant posts due to difficulty in employing appropriate field staff. Then, well, when we look at the annual report for economic planning, you know, there was no reasons that were actually highlighted in terms of what happened there. Then, in terms of the program on economic development and dialogue, it has underspent by 38% due to slow rate of filling of posts again and difficulty in employing appropriately skilled staff. So basically, the issue of appointment of staff is a problem in the department. And then what we did, we also looked at the in-year spending, as the chairperson has highlighted. We compared 2011-12 financial year and 2012-13 financial year. What we've managed to pick up is that the department has spent 82% of its total budget, that is by January 2013. However, if you compare that with what it has spent in 2012, it has spent 90% of its budget at the same time last year, against a benchmark of 83%. And then a different spending cycle is also observable over the 2 years, with May, July, October, and January months being high spending months, largely because of the transfer payments to public entities. And then spending behavior is smoother in 2012-13 than 2011-12, although there's been increases in May and January, which I think is what my acting chairperson has been indicating in terms of the in-year expenditure. Then, while we looked at the question of how well did the department do in 2011-12, looking at the targets that it has set itself. In total, the department has met 67% of its targets, that is in 2011-12. And then if you look at that by program, it has met 20%, that is for policy development, then only 80%, okay, for planning and coordination, and then, okay, 100% for development and dialogue program. Then when we look at the annual report, there were no reasons that were indicated in terms of why the outputs were not achieved. And then in terms of the indicators, basically the department reported only on 16 indicators. However, one would argue the case of whether 16 indicators are enough, also taking into account that the public department is a small department. And then when we look at the issue of non-financial information, that is for oversight purposes, we realize that some of the indicators are vague. For instance, there's an indicator that talks about the number of arrangements in the establishment of economic policy development institutions. And when one looks at this indicator, it is not clear how it is measured, basically. Then there's also, I suppose it links to the second bullet as well, where we picked up that some of the indicators are unclear in terms of how they are measured. For instance, as an example, there's an indicator on the number of sector, spatial, and economic plans reviewed or developed. yet the narrative only mentions engagement by Department on Economic Development and do not make reference to plans review. Then another issue is that the indicators have more than one output. For instance, as an example, there's an indicator that talks about the number of reports produced, strategies developed, and meetings held with provincial and local governments. Basically, this shows that there are three outputs in one indicator. And when we look at the issue of meetings is not really an indicator but an output. Then there's also an overlap on some of the indicators. For instance, there's an indicator that talks about the number of economic policies and sector strategies developed and policies developed to maintain second economy. When one look at this indicator, the policies basically, they are both policies, they address the issue of job creation strategies. Therefore, we are not sure how these policies are different from each other, because they address the same thing. And then in terms of the Auditor General, it has basically made no material findings on the reliability and validity of the performance information of the department. Then in terms of the Commission's recommendation for 2013-14, which the acting chairperson has already alluded to, we've made a number of recommendations for 2013-14 annual submission to Parliament. And government has only responded to those that are related to the division of revenue and has proposed that recommendations that are indirectly related to the division of revenue will be considered through another process. Then we've basically highlighted the recommendation that the Commission has made that is related to economic development. And basically the recommendation relates to the issue of unemployment and job creation, where the Commission has recommended that government should redirect government spending towards activities that directly or indirectly create jobs through enhancing productivity performance. For instance, activities such as healthcare, durable goods manufacturing, agriculture, community services, and hospitality should also inform the basis of much of the expanded infrastructure expenditure plan, which traditionally have gone chiefly to constructing activities such as building highways, bridges, dams, and floods. In terms of that recommendation, government indicated that it already has a number of job creation initiatives, as the acting chairperson has alluded. Thank you, chairperson. That's all from my side.
Yeah, look, I think maybe just to shed a bit of light on the recommendations and the kind of response that came from the Minister of Finance. In terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, chapter 9 of that act basically requires that the minister must, on tabling the division of revenue bill, must submit a response as to how that division of revenue bill has taken into consideration the Commission's recommendations. So that's the one part to that story. The second part is that in terms of Section 4 of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, the Commission's recommendations are supposed to be considered when the committees deal with the fiscal framework, the appropriations bill, and also the division of revenue bill. Now, the issues that have to inform the Commission's recommendations basically now are not simply related to the Division of Revenue Bill anymore in terms of how we decided to address those legal requirements from the Commission's side. So we have to make recommendations that deal with the fiscal framework, that also deal with the appropriations, all in one big submission that we submit in May. Now, I think from the Minister of Finance perspective, process now gets a bit confusing on how he must then respond to the Commission's recommendations, because there is no requirement to respond in terms of the fiscal framework, for example, on the Minister of Finance side in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. So that brings us back to a discussion that says when the Commission makes its recommendations, who does it make those recommendations to? In terms of the law, the Commission makes recommendations to Parliament, and then government must deal with it. So our view is that those recommendations that the Minister did not respond to basically must revert to those sectors or sector departments to whom they actually apply. So Parliament will have to deal with those recommendations in that particular context with the relevant department. We did brief all the departments that we thought were actually affected, so we invited them to one big meeting in June last year, and we did brief them about the recommendations that we have made, and there's a number of them that are for this particular committee. The ones that are important are contained in chapter two of the submission that was made in May. Chapter two and chapter seven of that submission. That's where you can actually pick them up if you want to follow up with the department on what they did with those recommendations and whether they have actually taken them on board in creating their own budget bid. Whether those recommendations are taken into consideration, I think that's something that the committee can raise with the department. Chairperson, I think that is where our presentation basically stops.
Thank you very much, Chair, Mr. Kumalo. There's a presentation from the FSC in relation to the 2012 performance and the 2013 projection. Mr. Hussein, the Magosa, Mr. Justice, Babantu.
Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. It was most interesting. I learn things every day here in this committee, so thank you very much. I just have two very short questions, and the first one being, I was particularly interested in the comments you made towards the end of your presentation, and I just would like to know that, I understand now that you submit your report to Parliament, and not necessarily to the individual departments itself, and I get the part of where the departments must look into it and deal with it, but in the previous years that you've put this report through to Parliament, do you get any feedback from any of the departments, and more especially the Economic Development Department, to say, we noted your recommendations and this is what we've done? And the reason why I ask that question is because it might very well be that you're chipping at a block every day and nothing's really coming off this thing. And then the second question is, there was this one graph in the presentation that dealt with the India expenditure. And I would like to get your view on what an ideal graph should look like. Because it, to some extent, might be a bit unfair on the departments, because there are occasions where there will be a spike in expenditure for obvious reasons. So in the Commission's view, what will an ideal spending pattern look like in that report? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Thanks for the input, Dumas and team. My first question is on slide on page 6, the bottom one. The underspending there of 23%. Is it? But it's page 6. Maybe I should.
Oh, the underspending part.
Underspending, yes. So if we could have more input on that, if you could speak more around it.
The 3.6%.
The 23.
Oh, okay.
The 23. Yes. And then my other question is, how is the department, when we say the department is not so much a delivery department, were we referring to FFC or were we referring to EDD? Just so that I'm more clear. And then the last one is what other tasks or what in which areas can the FFC still improve in its role vis-a-vis department? I'm saying this because we are relatively a new country, you know, in a way, a new democracy. So, but FFC has been in action throughout. How do we see ourselves? How do we see FFC growing to what it can call the optimum positioning, where it wants to see itself? Thanks, Coach.
Thank you, Chair.
On page 2, that is slide 3, on poverty reduction, that is still a challenge to development. I think we should also maybe have a point that speaks to immigration in the country. We know that the government, in as far as the party is concerned, do rely on consensus, but also we have a challenge of people in the country who may not be registered as residents in the country. And unfortunately, once they're in the country, they also benefit from our social security. So this challenge will forever be there, but I think it's important for us to highlight immigration as one of the challenges. And on the slow move on filling of vacancies, I think we are moving forward and backward. We are in the process of recruitment on the other side of the department, and on the other side we have this rapid recognition of senior management. So we gain and lose at the same time. So it's somewhat a quicker exercise. Thanks.
Thanks,
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson, and thanks for the presentation from the FFC. I want to check here whether, as we have said, we have put four main programs for the EDD. I'm a bit worried. I want to check the intergovernmental relations. When it comes to planning and coordinating, I'm saying this particularly with the department and the three spheres, from national, provincial, and local. What are the problems? Because I don't see how much are we spending when it comes to that, to coordinate horizontally and vertically. It is lacking. I mean, you can even see you cannot come up with how much money is being utilized or any budget for that. And we don't see when we are doing oversight when we go to the provinces. there is no coordination, nothing like to say it talks the programs of the national up to the local one. Even if you go to a termin and say, what is your relationship with the economic development national, nothing. They're just having their own as before, and we thought the establishment of this department was to coordinate through the three spheres. But if you go to the municipality and there's nothing, then you start asking, oh, what is this? As we have said, it's only that they meet at MINMEC. But thereafter, what? Then, I'm not sure who's supposed to do this, whether it's performance and evaluation department. You see, this thing of not filling the vacancy because of lack of skills, right? We don't believe it. There must be something else. You can't be sitting for 5 years and say you cannot employ because of the skills. Well, what are we doing with that? And who has come closer to that? What? What are the nitty-gritties? You can't just have the second thing and leave, because that is, I think, it's a lame excuse. What are we doing then? I'm not asking you, I'm saying, can you ever ask those questions to the department? Lastly, Chairperson, I wanted to check the relationship with you and the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, because we have received, we saw that there was a report, but how do you to relate to them? Or when they evaluate them, what are they using? Aren't they following what you are doing, the performance and monitoring steps?
Thanks, lovely team. Bob Kumalo, I like the fact that you raised the issues in relation to the role of entities in creating jobs. I think we've been asking that, and unfortunately, the regulatory bodies, like the Competition Commission, Competition Tribunal, ITEC, they don't seem to be having a clear cut, you know, role in terms of that. They say the work that they are doing is quite difficult for them to determine as to how many jobs can their work, for instance, create in the process of doing their work actually. Can you really say something around that, FFC? Because we try to put it in many ways, you know, to try and make them understand their role in terms of job creation. Especially that they coming from, you know, a department that is overseeing the creation of jobs. And some of them, when you look at their mandate, it's really to help in creating those necessary jobs in their various ways. But it's either they lack systems or, yeah, systems that can help them to monitor the creation of jobs in terms of the work that they're doing. The second one issue that I have here I'm really trying to understand the pie share here. on slide 9. I'm trying to understand it in terms of the actual spending and allocation. A lot of share is given to economic planning and coordination. In terms of your analysis, what actually is up? Is it the transfer? And if it's the transfers, is it then proper then to include the entities' money in the department if the department's share is so influenced by the transfers? Can the FSC perhaps recommend another way of channeling funds towards the entities so that we have a clean and clear picture of the actual allocation to the department, so that it is not cluttered by, you know, monies that necessarily don't belong to the department? And if not, how to ensure that the monies that especially take into consideration that some of these entities are independent in nature, while they get the money from the department, the department does not have a direct, for instance, control of their work. And yet when you look at the majority of the funds allocated are supposed to be transferred to those entities. How then does the department influence their work in order to safeguard the funds that have been transferred to the department, I mean to the entities? Of course, I'm asking these questions after assuming that the answer would be yes, the chunk of the money, bulk of the money is towards the transfer. There's something confusing me here. Compensation under economic classification slide. Compensation of employees. Can you really grow compensation of employees while you reduce goods and services? Does it make sense? Because I really need to understand, unless goods and services were mainly influenced, the allocation there or spending is mostly influenced by services which are mainly consultants. Yes. Because when we asked the department whether they're relying on consultants before, they told us no, they are using minimal consultants. But unfortunately, this spending doesn't say that, if what I'm saying is correct, because it doesn't support that. Can we be clear in terms of our analysis what influenced this reduction in the goods and services? There's too much spiking taking place in the in-year expenditure. I don't know if you have any influence in terms of your work in the recommendation, because to be honest, between November and January, it's quite there's that step, you know, there's less spending, it goes, and then you hear it on the fourth quarter jumping. I mean, and when you look at the areas, it's when they're supposed to be giving reports. I'm looking between April and June. It's not so much, you know, decline, and then it goes spiky high when it goes to June. And you see, that's when they're supposed to be preparing the quarterly report. And you ask yourself, the spikes, are they influenced by, I don't know, I just want to get clarity as to, in your assessment, how did you assess that, and what would have been the recommendation from your side in terms of the in-year expenditure? Because to me, it speaks of in-year monitoring also by the department. Is there any taking place, in your opinion? And how can we, as the portfolio committee, for instance, help in ensuring that this in-year monitoring is done on a monthly basis? We are told that there's no provision anywhere where it obliges, for instance, the department to monitor on a monthly basis, but at least on a quarterly basis. But in my experience, I know that there was a provision where departments have to submit at least their monthly reports where after reconciling their monthly activities and expenditures. And at the end of the quarter, those 3 months are then consolidated into one. So I really feel that if that can be clarified. I think on the FMC recommendations on slide 17, I think this thing can be improved. It's very difficult to understand what you are saying here unless you clarify. It's only after you have clarified it that it was easier for us to understand. But the way it's written, it's a bit too ambiguous and not clearly understood. I think maybe for future purposes, if you can do that. Thanks, Sacha. May we hand over to you? You have a follow-up just before you?
Yes, please, thank you. Just a short question. Do you also do an analysis on the entities of economic development, or just the department itself?
Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, okay.
Yeah, Chairman, it's actually a comment rather than a question. On page 4, slide 8, that we have this amount of money improving conditions of service in public entities. But in our department here, I mean, the repeat resignation is actually a contradiction of this improvement of conditions, that why do people resign when conditions are improved? Mm-hmm. Coming back to 13-2, that there must be something.
No, thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, honorable members, for the comments and questions. I think let me start off with the Honorable Hussein's last question, and whether we get into the entities, if it's taxpayers' money and you would like us to do that at your request, we can actually do that. It's not a problem. We focus in terms of the Act, in terms of the FMC Act, there are decisions that we take as a commission when we see that there's something wrong there that we need to look at. And sometimes we tend to look at the departments rather than the entities that report to them or that fall under them. But definitely if you would like us to look at those entities and provide you with a story, we can actually, we're empowered to do that in terms of the FFC Act. We can actually do that as a special, dealing with a special request from Parliament. Let me go back to your first question. Do we get feedback from the department? Like I indicated that we actually, once we have tabled our submission in Parliament, we identify the departments that we think those recommendations will impact on. And we invite them to a very big meeting where our technical staff take the officials that will have been delegated by the Director General to represent the department. We actually take them through in great detail what the recommendations mean for the particular department. Now, some departments actually come back to us. Some departments will come back to us because Parliament, the relevant portfolio committee, would have called them to come and respond to the Commission's recommendations, and then you pick it up from there. For example, the Department of Education, there was quite a number of recommendations that related to higher education. But we were also aware that there was a ministerial task team that was actually working on funding arrangements for higher education institutions and reviewing the funding formula and all of that. So we had to deal with them directly, and the department also dealt with us in another way. So it's really up to the department. For us, as I said, the recommendations are primarily made to Parliament. So if Parliament wants to call the Commission together with the department to come and interrogate what the recommendations being made by the Commission mean for the department and how is the department going to carry those forward, it's really up to Parliament to do that. And some portfolio committees approach it in that particular manner. You spoke about the graph. Would there be an ideal graph for in-year spending? I think it depends on, and I'll mix that with the response to Honorable Mavasa when you ask about when I say that it's not a delivery. Maybe I was not very precise on what I actually meant. Every department has delivery a responsibility. What I meant was there are some departments like Public Works that would deal with big infrastructure project construction, and those have cycles. And so in terms of when they pay and how they pay, it's really about what's happening to those projects. If you then go to finance, for example, you go to the Ministry of Finance or the Treasury, and you look at a graph from the Treasury, it is unlikely to look like, especially the red one. It will probably be very close to the blue one. That's what you will actually see if you look at the Treasury performing its own functions. It's a coordinating. It's really about coordinating. So its policy is coordination and making sure that things are actually happening. So your expenditure trend must actually approach the. The ideal is actually a linear one. So if we give you 100,000, you must spend it in the four quarters in equal amounts.
Yeah.
But that rarely happens. But what we want to see is something that approximates that, even though you have to. So my explanation for that red one there is a learning department. How do you manage this? Because there are payment schedules that must be adhered to. There are all of those things that you must actually do. Now, the learning curve, basically, for me, basically, when I see that graph, it's got those dips and ups and dips and ups. Can you be able to bring it to be a little bit flatter than what is happening there? And when I was saying that there's something that is happening, I was actually talking about that graph. It's still not very good. Doesn't look good. But there is something that is definitely happening that's moving up from what it was in 2011-12 to what 2012-13 looks like. You must have said something to them about how they are actually spending. And I think, Honorable Chairperson, your question about the reporting in here, definitely there are monthly reports that must be submitted. Every accounting officer, including myself, you have to submit a monthly report. And if, for example, somebody decides that they want to know why my monthly report, even before the end of the quarter, I don't think that there's anything that should stop you from actually saying, no, we want to see what has been happening in the past 2 months. The reports are there. I think you can actually download them. You can even download them and look at them and see what they've been actually doing to the team. If the department is not able to come, you will get the National Treasury. They will actually, because if you don't submit that report as an accounting officer, you have created an offence in terms of the PFMA. So those must actually be submitted on a monthly basis. I think it's like 2 weeks after the end of the month. That's the latest that you can submit. If you go beyond that, you've already broken the law. So those are actually there. Now
we've tried with National Treasury. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, they're referring us back to the line function department. because they are saying that's the role of the line function department. And I don't know, because sometimes you're not able to get those things. That's why I'm asking, maybe on your side you could be able to assist.
No, if it is really a problem, let me pick it up with the commission. When we table our submission now for 2014, we're tabling that submission in May. And in fact, we are meeting this week at the commission, Thursday, Friday. So I'll just, Lydia, just make a note of that. We'll table it with the commission, and we can actually insert something in the submission about that. Yeah. Then let me go to Honorable Mabasa, your questions. The first question is, can we unpack the underspending on the economic policy and planning? I think I'll ask Lydia to answer that. Just noted. I'll ask Lydia to answer that one. I think the issue of whether I was referring to the department or the commission, you asked about, is it a non-delivery department? No, it is a delivery department. But the nature of the deliverables are most likely to be paid for in a linear kind of a way, rather than some department like Public Works, for example, that has to engage in construction projects that have cycles. So all I was saying was that this is the primary role of this department is to coordinate policy and ensure that certain things are happening here and certain things are happening there. Now, coming back to what I think is a very key question that you've asked, the intergovernmental aspect in this department. I am not actually sure that this department has even a division that deals with intergovernmental relations. It doesn't. There is a gentleman that was in that department, is late now, with whom we were having discussions, who was one of the advisors to the minister, that we were discussing with, because when we go down to the provinces, we also get the same question that you are asking. How can we as provinces coordinate the economic, because there's a lot of, in different provinces they've got different types of a similar kind of a ministry in the province. So some is the economic development and tourism, in other provinces it's something else. So you find these things are there. Now, if you look at our annual submission, I think it must be the second last chapter. That's the one that dealt with the roles of provinces and municipalities on economic growth and development, trying to link the new growth path with what provinces and municipalities, what role must be played by those. And it's very clear there that you will have a very significant role for this department, Economic Development Department, to play in coordinating the activities of municipalities as growth centers and of provinces as developmental drivers within a province. And it's a very interesting thing when you look at the numbers. But then if you look at the plan and then you say, where do I pick up on aspects of the new growth path in this plan for this municipality or in this plan for this province? Now we've got an added thing that's come up, that's the National Development Plan. It's even going to be more confusing. So you actually require a more, I'm not sure whether there's actually a MINMEC, Honorable Mabasa, for economic development. I have not had the opportunity, if it is there, to actually interact with it.
It is, but I don't
think it's actually. So it's not exactly functional, is it? It's something that I think we need to take a step further, because the provinces have raised it with us as well. So we might want to work out some sort of a recommendation that we can put together that strengthens the institutional arrangement and the coordinating role of the Department of Economic Development in those areas. I think it's at the center of that, actually, of the microeconomic policies of government across the spheres. I think, Honorable Totesi, most of your issues that you raised were comments, and I must add that when you refer to migration, inbound migration, in the context of poverty reduction, I think it's very important also to look at it as there is migration internally, there is the migration of people coming from outside of South Africa. Because if you are dealing with issues of economic development in a local environment, you need to have stability in population movements to allow you to plan properly in terms of projects and where you locate them. Because one of the things that we have picked up following the release of the census statistics, the biggest challenge in South Africa is actually internal migration. It's a migration from one province to another, from one municipality to another. I can tell you that if you look at municipalities, there are some municipalities who have lost so much people that their equitable share that must go to them has to be reduced by 80%.
Yeah.
Just because people have moved from that municipality. Now, it's a nightmare if you have to be actually planning and you're trying to say that people must locate where they come from, and they must actually, it's a nightmare. But that is actually happening. There are some municipalities whose equitable share, then, because they receive so many people, the equitable share must rise that much. If you blow it up to the provinces, you will find that provinces like the Eastern Cape, KZN, must lose a lot of money, billions that they must lose. I think KZN must lose about 6 billion. It's a big province, it's a rural province, that is where you actually need as much money as you can lay your hands on. But because people are moving, yeah, they are moving away. But this is the problem, the challenge is that they don't move away forever. They come back at some point. And our also the biggest challenge is that they move away and go and work in Gauteng. But if you check December, they are all gone. They will come back again in January.
Yeah, and
so get your quota. Now, the point is that it's a serious challenge, the issue of migration. So I'm not sure that there are easy answers on how one can actually deal with that. With that problem, but it's something that we have to be very alert to in whatever it is that we do.
Yeah, I was actually specifically referring to immigration from other outside South Africa, because those are the people who do not fit anywhere in our register. Because we also count them in millions, not even thousands. So it does make an impact on our budget.
Yeah. Well, I think for those illegal immigrants, one would assume that the Department of Home Affairs' efforts in dealing with the issues around refugees and some of the pacts that have been signed, and also strengthening, because our borders are very porous as well, so strengthening those would be able to control and be able to register those people. But obviously that's a different set of issues that we have to deal with, because some of them are based on international commitments that that South Africa has actually made. And so it's very difficult to say once they are in here, separate them and say, no, but you're not South African. It's very difficult. But I think Home Affairs is doing quite a substantial amount of work to try and document those undocumented citizens, undocumented. But yeah, no, I do understand the issue that you're talking about. The issue of staffing...
Just before you move on, in terms of, because that's obviously related also to the issues of migration, are related to they're related to how the equitable formula is designed. I'm not sure what is the percentage share of that formula. What I mean is that within the formula itself, I remember that a lot of share was given to population. Is it still the same?
Yeah.
And how many percent is given to economic activity, for instance, under development? Because before we thought the under development can match up also the can close up the gap of the population or the economic activity, let me say so, because some areas. Like the municipalities you and Mem were talking to, might have a very small revenue base, but maybe the issue around population might assist. The issue around underdevelopment might up their income or allocation.
Yeah, no, the population in one form or another, so let me just say demographic pattern, in the provincial equitable share, it's 97% of the allocations are driven by population. So if you just take the formula and you test what explains an allocation that goes to a province, you'll find that 97% of it is explained by people and their characteristics. So it's still heavily biased towards population. Economic activity is a very small amount. because even in terms of the components, because you've got the components, economic activity is just 1%. Poverty is 3%. So that's just in the components, but not because the components, poverty is also people. It's not focusing on the area where people live. It's just taking people as individuals and saying there's this number of poor people, not looking at, for example, what kind of schools do they have or what kind of clinics or hospitals. They doesn't look at that. So, yeah, it's just income. So basically 97% of the allocation that's cemented in that particular way. Now, we have had quite a number of provinces actually raising the fact, and I think I agree with them, that whilst it might have made a lot of sense back in 97 when the formula was introduced to actually use population, and the focus really was to focus on people that were previously disadvantaged, that were left out of the services. And so to look at people at that particular point, also because those were the numbers that were there that you could actually rely on relative to any other data that you had, it might have been a good thing at that particular point in time. But I think as we have moved on and rolled out infrastructure in some of these areas where people are moving away from, that infrastructure does not follow the people, so people don't live with the schools. And there are some people that still remain to attend those schools. And if we take away the money so that it follows those that have left, what happens to the schools that have been built and built? Yeah. Exactly. So it's all of those things that have actually been put in place that we need to actually find a different approach. And we have basically indicated to the finance committee that we will be engaging with the key stakeholders around reviewing the equitable share formula for provinces. We just completed reviewing the local government one, and I think we managed to address quite a number of issues, and I think using the same type of an approach we'll be able to review appropriately the provincial equitable share formula. And then let's go to the issue of staffing as a challenge. I think, Honorable Protesi, what you are raising is that we are saying there's a challenge to recruit the appropriate people, but at the same time, there's also a lot of staff turnover at those levels. And I think it's something that we have to accept that indeed is the case, because that's how job markets I think work. The challenge really is how do we develop retention strategies at one level, and also like put together policies that actually attract. Because there's a lot of young people, and I think that are actually out there, that have the necessary education. It might not be as good as we wanted to say, because once you've been to university, I don't think that when somebody has been to university and graduated, that person cannot actually be trained to work in any environment. I think it's something that we need to think about, how we link our education system with what government needs. I think a good example of how to deal with an issue of skills and retaining people that I have seen working is at the National Treasury. They build quite a lot of their own through internship programs that they've sustained over a very long period of time. So those internship programs basically assist them in identifying talent, and they then design retention strategies. So the National Treasury is one example that some of these departments can actually look to and say, how do we actually replicate that kind of an approach? I think it works perfectly, very well, from my side. I can't say anything about these things because I think the Public Service Commission, part of its responsibility is looking at these types of issues, and I would suggest that to discuss some of these issues around vacancies, you might want to take some presentation from the Public Service Commission. We have shared a platform with them in one of the committees where they actually came and presented the state of the public service and where there are vacancies and why there are vacancies and what needs to be done when vacancies are not filled for what period of time. So there's quite a substantial report that they've actually put together that will show you and answer some of the questions that you have raised around why would you have a budget going like this. I mean, the story of consultants that came out with the Auditor General's report, which was presented early this year. If you link it to what the Public Service Commission has, you will find that negative 6% on goods and services might actually be responding to that story of consultants. Because, you know, when you have vacancies and you're saying you need particular type of people, you go for consultants to provide that kind of a service, but where there is a vacancy, you are likely to be paying probably three times, in some cases, more than you would be paying for somebody that you've actually employed in that particular position. I mean, we have known of instances where people that have been working in a department as an employee resign. After a couple of months, they come back to do some stuff, same stuff as a consultant, and they get like four times or five times what they were getting when they were actually working there. Mm. So it's those types of things I would suspect that demonstrate that goods and services. So it probably was not goods and services that were adding value to. Okay, I've dealt with the issue of intergovernmental relations, Honorable Ntuli. And then there's the relationship between the Commission and the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. I would say that we don't actually have any direct relationship with that department. We have, however, attempted in the early days when the department was being set up, but there's been a lot of movement of people to actually create a relationship with them, because we find that there's quite a lot of synergies in terms of what we do and what they are actually established to do. So that is something that relationship is something that we are still trying to work on. So at this point in time, I wouldn't say that there's any direct or meaningful relationship between us and the department. Honorable Chair, you asked a question about the regulatory bodies and their role in job creation and the difficulty in actually getting them to explain or enunciate what their role in job creation is. I mean, looking from outside, if I look at a regulatory body like the Competition Commission and just thinking about what the role of the Competition Commission is and how that work of the Commission can contribute to job creation, because they approve mergers, they approve acquisitions, so there's a whole range of things that they have to deal with that directly give signals to operations of businesses, how they can and how they cannot actually operate. So there is a role there. It's just a question of getting them to be able to document what the impact of decisions that they have made, what difference the decision has made in terms of addressing some of the key challenges. So it's something that one can request that they build into their own performance information. Are they able to follow up on cases like that that they have actually dealt with and then looked at what the impact of that decision was, let's say on employment? I know that there was quite a big issue with one measure that they were dealing with that the commission had approved, and then the tribunal had some issues, and then the minister had some issues, and then there were all sorts of issues. But the concerns from the union were that these people will shed labor and they will start using cheap labor. It's a very genuine concern. And now, once the Competition Commission has made that decision, are they able to actually follow up and say, no, we've got a research department that actually does this, so can we actually collect that information and check what has actually happened to this thing? That might be one way of getting them to... I mean, as a commission, from our side, I'll tell you that the Minister of Finance, basically, because we follow under his ministry, requested that we actually provide support that actually say how it is that we are actually creating, contributing to the creation of employment for young people specifically. Up to today, I'm still thinking, what am I going to use as an indicator of whether or not it is? So it's something that it's not impossible. I think if people apply their minds, they should be able to.
But don't you think that is influenced mainly by, you know, people channeling their minds towards compliance, you know, addressing issues of compliance rather than developmental issues?
Yeah. No, I agree with you fully that, especially with regulatory entities, it's about compliance. Everybody looks at what is the Auditor General going to say, and let me tick those boxes that will please the Auditor General. And so you get a very nice report from the Auditor General, but when we get down to the bottom, what is it that we have done? And that is why one always has to go beyond the report of the Auditor General when you actually evaluate performance of the department, because the Auditor General measures you against what you have decided you are going to do on your performance. It's not like saying, what are you expected to do? So you will say, no, what is your mandate? How are you going to do this? So you put your own, I mean, that chart there that we had that basically shows what the department has set itself, and when the time comes, the Auditor General comes and says, so where are we? And then you tick a box and, no, but there's a barrier. So we must explain those things. But that's what you did. That's what you said for yourself. Is it complete in terms of your mandate? Is it complete? So there are some missing things that you got, but just because you want to comply and you want to, you might actually be doing that.
I'm happy that the Auditor General is moving towards outcome-based instead of this compliance issue, because it's really killing our public service performance. Because I wanted to ask you as to, in terms of, course, I don't know whether you chapter 9, 13, or what institutions are able to also advise each other, because you see, when you as FFC make recommendations to, for instance, people like Treasury, wouldn't you then, because, I mean, this outcome-based has been, I mean, the KFMA was effected from 1999, and it's more on outcomes than on actual outputs like it used to be with the Exchequer Act. But then the problem is it takes time for them to really move towards developmental, which would then lead them to every department was reporting on their development outcomes than on the outputs themselves. How then do you advise, would you advise Treasury to start moving towards that so that it can improve service delivery? Because at the end of the day, we have, as portfolio committees, as parliament, we are going to be blamed that we're not doing our work. And yet our work is channeled by what is before us, on the table, because we can't go beyond that, because we are dependent on Auditor General's report, we are dependent on the Section 32 reports that you're receiving. Beyond that, there's nothing else we can do except by just making noise and writing recommendations to the to Parliament to take decisions that are mostly not even implemented or considered by departments. What I'm trying to check here is the role of the either section chapter 9 institutions or yourselves as chapter 13 institutions, that is the Public Service Commission and yourself.
No, let me say that there's a forum which is called the Forum for Institutions Supporting Democracy. That's an umbrella body of all those chapter 9 and chapter, I think the other one is chapter 2 or chapter, I think it's chapter 2. And then you've got the Public Service Commission chapter 10 and then the FFC chapter 13. We all belong in this group, but the way in which we relate, those that have got mandates that seem to be around the same kinds of areas, it seems to be. For example, we have a memorandum of understanding with the Auditor General and the Public Service Commission. We're just about to put together one with the Human Rights Commission because they have started the process on charters, right? Charters and all of those kinds of things, which also have implications for the finances and how the finances are spent. So I think the issue that you are raising is important in the sense that as those institutions, our primary role is to advise and make recommendations to Parliament. So it's to strengthen Parliament's own capacity and alert Parliament to some certain shortcomings that we might be actually identifying, also good things that we might be identifying within government. And hopefully as we move forward, because there's an office that was established in Parliament, it's called the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy, that falls under the Deputy Speaker, which is supposed to coordinate the activities of those entities with the relevant portfolio committees in Parliament and how some of the recommendations and reports coming from those institutions fit into the parliamentary process. I'm not sure how far that is actually, that office has actually been capacitated to be able to handle the amount of information. But what I know is that the current chairperson of that forum, who is the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, is arranging a meeting with the speaker to actually follow up on some of those issues to ensure that, because it is a fact that most of these institutions, they put so many reports, but those reports just get lost in Parliament, and they don't get to where they are supposed to get just because of the way Parliament operates and not making a judgment about how the administrative structure of Parliament operates, but it can be very confusing. Let me move on to the issue of the share of planning and coordination in that budget. You are very right. big chunk of that green piece of the pie is actually transfers and subsidies to these entities. And you know, I'm very surprised. Like when you say they are independent, are they independent to such an extent that they cannot actually account to the committee or to the ministry? Let me say the ministry, not the department. Is it like they are independent in that sense? Or they are simply independent in that you can give them these subsidies, but they have a program that they must actually implement against which they must account?
Their independence is actually confusing to us also, although we try to guide in this regard. Their independence is in relation to their function, how they function. A minister cannot, for instance, dictate as to which route they should take in doing what.
What about that?
So that's another issue, that they governed, you know, by certain legislation that some interpreted as though they are independent. Like the very same Competition Commission, the issue that the example that you gave. There wasn't going to be any need for the minister to go to the ministers actually to launch an appeal on a decision that was taken by its own entity, because by its nature it means if they take a decision, it's the minister who took a decision, isn't it? But because of their nature, the way they understand themselves, they're independent, so they can take whatever decision that they take, independent of the minister. That's what I'm trying to say. It means that the minister doesn't have any control over them. You see, I think that is the type of independence I'm talking about. You give them money, but you can't tell them what to do with that money. They have to decide themselves on what to do with that money, and not they just account through paper that this is what we've done, and this is where we're heading. Even though, you know, in terms of the Act, it gives them clear mandates, this is what you're supposed to be doing, but at the end of the day, in terms of your deliverables and your key performance indicators, you're not speaking to those issues.
Maybe Chairperson, in that context, then let me not answer you on this question now. Let me just go back and have a look at the legislation governing this institution, and also have a look at the accounting structures. I know that they have boards. I suppose the Competition Commission, the board is the chairperson of the commission and his deputy. But let me have a little bit. I will actually have a look at this particular issue, and then I'll come back to you in writing around how we can actually, because what you are saying is like we want to know whether that money is actually spent in line with what the broader objectives of government and the taxpayers' money must actually be doing, and I think it's a very key issue that we need to look at. So we'll come back to you in writing on that one. And then, the issue of compensation of employees versus goods and services was the last one. I've already touched on that one. Lydia, there was one question that I said you must go back and respond to.
The question is around the issue of the 23% on economic policy. Well, so far, the explanation that is given to the department, of course, relates to the filling of vacant posts. And I must say, Honorable Chair, that is very worrying, because in terms of how they do their budget, for instance, this is a program within the department. So when they plan, it's like they have to provide projections or a budget in terms of how many posts do they want to fill within that particular program. So meaning that this program, they identify the number of posts and then they allocate a budget, but they don't spend it. Another thing that is worrying is that if they do it like that, they should also keep in mind, which is something that I think they know, that if a budget is ring-fenced for compensation of employees, you cannot shift it to other programs. So because of that, they end up not spending the budget, and they have to give an explanation, you know, in terms of why they couldn't. But if it's compensation, you cannot move it to any other program. Yes. Yes. Yes, because if you look at other programs, of course, it also relates to economic development and dialogue. It's the same situation. However, if you look at economic planning, I think it also links to a question where you raised why about 86% is allocated to economic planning. Just to highlight that this program is the one, is a unit that is responsible for the oversee of public entities. So it shows that, it means that a larger portion of the budget is allocated to that unit. However, if you look at the difference in terms of how much they spend and how much was allocated, there isn't that much difference, meaning that they are able to spend the budget because they have to transfer to public entities. So basically, that's what the numbers are sort of telling us. Then I'm not going to talk too much on the issue of the goods and services, because my chairperson, acting chairperson, I think he has already given you an answer that I was going to give as well. Thank you, chairperson.
Thank you very much. I think there's a lot of work that, fortunately, the department is coming on the third quarter report. I think that's where we'll be able to ask questions. And we need really to thank you for bringing this up to us, clarifying, you know, some of the most of the issues. That has to do with the spending patterns of the department. And obviously, it will also help in analyzing and being able to ask the right questions in relation to the 2013 and 14 budget. Even though they are projections, but at least you can be able to put a sense and compare whether it's growth or whether there's reduction, and ask the relevant questions. On that note, we'd want to really thank you very much. We will take your advice. We will invite the Public Service Commission and also the department, especially on the issues related to the vacancies. And perhaps try once more. Maybe we have a joint meeting with the standing committee on appropriation. That I think would help us to clearly understand the issues around the formula and the concerns raised by members here around the status A information. How does it help in transforming some of the areas, especially the previously disadvantaged areas that are mostly affected by this equitable share issue? minister, because I know in Mpumalanga where I come from, there's one district municipality that always complains, because they also do their own house-to-house counting of people. And because the district boundary takes care of areas that borders with Mozambique and Swaziland, therefore, it's very clear that it is affected. I think those are the areas where you find, you know, most of the recipients of social security, you know, come from. They just cross the border, collect their grants, go back to Swaziland or Mozambique, you see, with ease, with no problems. So if it's time to give any kind of help, they cross the border, they go back. I mean, in terms of the poverty alleviation packages and so forth, they cross the border. And if you say to that municipality, it hasn't spent money, it has, because it's, they're taking care of a particular population, and they wouldn't know who has a right to be in South Africa and who doesn't have a right. And whereas in terms of allocation, they are not taken care of. Those are the discrepancies that perhaps need to be, and I know people from Free State are suffering from the same with Lesotho, and from Limpopo, they're suffering with people from Botswana and Zimbabwe. So those are the challenges that come with the territory, each territory. So if we could, you know, dealing with development issues is quite a difficult issue. And if not managed well, other areas will forever be disadvantaged as against others. So thank you very much, and with also your commitment to continue helping us in understanding our work, I think it's highly appreciated. Let me then also thank the members for their attendance and participation. Some of us still have to go and finalize our preparations for debate this afternoon. So others have already left, especially from the opposition. Otherwise, thank you very much for the attendance and also for the briefing. We will end the meeting here. Thank you.